So welcome back. Just to recap, so far we've looked at how the early press distributed information to the growing upper middle class, and in the process created, a celebrity culture and an appetite for a celebrity culture that featured giants like Haydn, who were astounding in their greatness, Haydn and Mozart. But by then, the public had kind of gotten used to the idea that spectacular things were happening all around them, because in many ways they were. The steam engine, the electric telegraph, the flush toilet, the submarine, bifocals, the threshing machine, gas lighting, batteries, the bicycle, they all appeared in one generation leading up to 1800. Machines were really changing the way people lived. And people really wanted to believe that machines could do anything. Writers from the time, for example, were fascinated with the idea of mechanical dolls coming to life. And for a brief time, then, the reading public was both worldly and gullible. And that was just fine for one of history's great hucksters, Johann Nepomuk Maltzel. He was an engineer who really did design a few things himself, ear trumpets for the deaf, and a mechanical doll that spoke and had moving eyes. But he's best known for two devices that other people invented, but that he exploited, sold, and took credit for. One was the metronome. He didn't invent the metronome, but when on a piece of music you might see MM equals 60, and that's telling you how fast it will go. Well, MM, as people think it stands for metronome marking, actually stands for Maltzel's metronome. He marketed it that way, even though it wasn't really his. And the other thing was the chess Turk. Now, the chess Turk was a chess table with a life-sized puppet who could move the chess pieces and usually won. Maltzel took it on tour and did very well. If anybody asked, he'd open the door on the cabinet to the right and show the elaborate gears hard at work. He didn't, however, open the cabinet on the left, where a very small man was hidden. William Lewis, a tiny chess master, watched the game from mirrors and worked the puppet with levers inside. And Maltzel and Lewis toured the Turk throughout Europe. They even played Napoleon and won, and nobody caught on. But Napoleon wasn't Maltzel's only famous victim. The other was Ludwig van Beethoven. Beethoven used Maltzel's ear trumpets to help his failing ears, and he loved the metronome. So when Maltzel came up with a mechanical orchestra, the Panharmonicon, and suggested Beethoven write something for it so they could take it on tour, it seemed like a sure thing. Well, it wasn't. The piece that he wrote, Wellington's Victory, was a defeat in every sense. And the tour never happened, nor did the money. Maltzel and Beethoven fell out and even exchanged lawsuits, but that didn't put Beethoven off mechanics at all, because there was still one machine that had completely captured his heart, and that was the piano. Beethoven loved the piano, but it was hardly a healthy relationship for the instrument. His ferocity at the keyboard instantly wiped out the classical ideal of restraint and taste, and it also literally wiped out whatever unfortunate piano he happened to be abusing at the time. "He asked me to turn pages," one writer tells us, "for a Mozart concerto, but I was mostly wrenching snapped strings and freeing broken hammers. I leapt back and forth, jerking out strings, disentangling hammers, turning a page. I worked harder than he did." Because of that kind of abuse, the English piano and their makers, they created bigger and stronger instruments to put up with the kind of thing that Beethoven was delivering to them. And so the trade war with the lighter Austrian pianos was largely over. They just weren't strong enough to withstand that kind of treatment. In 1825, the year Beethoven died, a British journal ran a study on how, theoretically, a small person might be able to hide inside the chess Turk and work the puppet from there. Maltzel left Europe almost immediately. He took his act to the US. But the age of mass gullibility had passed there as well, because two 13-year-old kids in Baltimore who happened to be climbing a tree saw a short man climbing into the back of the Turk before a show. They called the Baltimore Gazette, and Maltzel had to leave town in a hurry once again. He was found dead of alcohol poisoning 10 years later on a freighter floating in the harbor in La Guaira, Venezuela. In 1838, he was 66 years old. We're going to hear a Beethoven sonata with the first movement played on the pianoforte and then the rest on the modern piano. The shift that you'll hear is close to how the instrument changed in Beethoven's lifetime, but he never got to hear it. John Broadwood and Sons sent Beethoven a 6-octave grand in 1818. It was a wonderful instrument, strong and resonant, but it came too late. Beethoven was already deaf, and he pounded at it in the studio, trying to drive the sound into his ears until, just like all the others, the beautiful grand was a sorry tangle of splinters and wire. In the end, the only real piano to Beethoven was the one in his head, and all the others, no matter what they were made of, just never measured up.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I can just imagine what that did. He wrote that in 1803. That's you know, not 15 years after the Haydn piece that we heard before the intermission. Just an unbelievable change in what the instrument can do and what was expected of it. And even though by then he was already famous for destroying pianos, piano makers still wanted his endorsements, and so they were sending him instruments more all the time. One firm to do that in 1804 was the French firm run by the Erard brothers. They were in Paris, Sebastian and Jean-Baptiste Erard. They were responsible for all kinds of piano improvements, better action, pedals that worked better, extra strings in the upper end, a bigger keyboard. They sold to many famous customers, including Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, and they also sold to their customers who ran away to London. They opened a shop there, actually, in 1791. And when Sebastian Erard died in 1831, the company employed 80 craftsmen in 19 shops making pianos and harps. Then Jean-Baptiste's son took over the business, Pierre, and he tripled that in 12 years. And that's about what happened to the city of Paris in that time. After the revolution in 1789, Paris was more or less 30 years behind London, but it caught up in a decade. Gas, lighting, public transportation, railways, canals, bridges, they all sprung up in quick succession. And along with all of those, lots of wealthy homes and lots of pianos and a tremendous market for pianists. Paris seemed to attract them in packs, each one trying to outdo the last. Merely playing beautifully wasn't nearly enough. You had to have a shtick. There were speed demons, there were dreamers, thumpers, extroverts, introverts, poets, scholars. And there was also a press that was only too happy to write about all of those. Paris saw an explosion of papers during the revolution. And once writers had felt the thrill of inciting the public, they weren't going back. So the scholarly journals that had always printed criticism were more or less pushed aside. And now in piano-mad Paris, with its circuit of wealthy salons, the music critic became a real force. Salons were the living rooms of the rich. Pianists weren't necessarily paid to play there, but if they wowed the crowd and they got written up the next day, then they'd attract very wealthy students who were just about willing to pay anything. On top of that, if the artist in question happened to have something a little more interesting about them, that wouldn't hurt either, both for the press and for the inter-salon gossip network. So there are two pianists that really topped the charts, the gossip chart and the newspaper chart in 1840s Paris. One was a flamboyant virtuoso who shacked up with a countess. That was Franz Liszt. The other was a pale consumptive who lived with a sexually ravenous cross-dressing novelist and her three teenage girls. That was Frédéric Chopin. Liszt and Chopin were the next step in the piano contest that had started with Clementi and Mozart years before. The brand of piano was no longer an issue. The English piano had prevailed, and French makers like Erard and Pleyel were making bigger and stronger pianos on the English model. So the question became what to do with them. Liszt was the first to play a solo piano recital. Before that, the idea of a pianist playing without any other kind of string accompaniment was just unthinkable. But Liszt was such a draw, there really wasn't need for anyone else. He would play a couple of numbers and then, according to one account, leave the stage and descend into the room, chatting with all the gracious condescension of a prince until he felt disposed to return to the piano. Chopin couldn't compete with Liszt's bravado, but the depth of his passion and the intimacy of his touch were legendary. He requires no powerful sounds to produce contrasts, a fellow composer wrote. His soft notes require no more than a breath. Well, the glory that was Paris in the 1840s didn't survive the decade. Chopin died in 1849, and Liszt left for Weimar, and traded in his countess for a princess, and decided he wanted to be a priest, as long as he could keep the princess. That last part was a bit of a problem, so he ended up being an abbot of sorts, which was fine, because although Liszt did experience some kind of a religious conversion at some point, before long he and his acolytes were really worshiping Richard Wagner as much as anyone else. Now, Wagner revolutionized music in the mid-1800s, and mostly around the issue of size. And the piano was getting bigger, as you heard. I mean, there's a bit of a, we've skipped something, honestly. There's an instrument between this one and that one, before there was a metal frame. The Broadwood that Beethoven got sent to him was made of only of wood. So it didn't have quite the same brilliance and volume as the Steinway Grand that you're hearing. Metal frames appeared around the 1850s. And then volume and brightness and size and everything was more possible. And along with that, Wagner did the same thing for operas and for concert music as well. His vision for the largesse of sound and of story was so huge that no musician alive could afford to ignore it. And the funny thing is that while Liszt was in Weimar, he gave his musical blessing to the piano's next big thing. It was the man who, before too long, would be pitted against Liszt and Wagner as the defender of the musical soul of Vienna. And that was the 20-year-old Johannes Brahms. Liszt gave him his blessing. Vienna, where Brahms was from, more or less, was in the middle of the same kind of renaissance that London and Paris had gone through 30 and 60 years before. In 1857, Vienna still had the medieval ramparts around the city and ditches, as if they were expecting the Turks to knock at the door again any moment. Well, 10 years after 1857, the ramparts were gone, the ditches filled in, and the streets were lined with parks and stately public buildings. Vienna had regulated its drinking water supply, brought in gas and electricity. The economy soared, the population boomed, industry as well exploded, and the Viennese press became very powerful too. And in the process, that city's venerable music critics got hooked on the same publicity tool that the Viennese emperor had about a century before, and that was the musical battle. Now, the truth of it was that Brahms really kind of liked Wagner's music at first. And Liszt liked Brahms' music, even if Wagner was his son-in-law. And although Wagner said some very nasty things about Brahms and his music, he said nasty things about everybody, even Liszt. Even so, there was a fight, and it started with the Czech-born music critic who understood the power of the press better than anybody. His name was Eduard Hanslick. He wrote for the Vienna Times and the New Free Press. And when he saw a Wagner opera in 1845, it terrified him, and he decided he'd better do something about it. To Hanslick, Wagner was the enemy of the Viennese musical tradition. And at first, Hanslick just wrote terrible things about Wagner's music. Things like, quote, "It reminds me of the old Italian painting of a martyr whose intestines are slowly unwound from his body on a reel," end quote. But complain as he might, Hanslick could see that Wagner's popularity was growing in Vienna all the same. So he decided what he really needed was a Viennese anti-Wagner, and Brahms was the obvious choice. Now, Hanslick said that Brahms' music was, quote, "full of mind and spirit," whereas Wagner's was, quote, "a boneless mollusk swimming into the immeasurable." But Hanslick really had no idea what he'd started, because it turned out that vitriol and anger and hatred for anything, whatever it was, sold papers. Vienna was bursting with pride in its new self, and Wagner was the perfect symbol for the old hated Prussian domination, and the papers needed a story. So pretty soon, if a Wagner piece was being played in Vienna, an ardent claque of young Brahms lovers was sure to show up and hiss and boo, cause a riot if they could, and then collect their pay afterwards out back. And so, after starting out as a vehicle that brought the piano from Florence to Germany and the world, and made careers and distributed art, just 150 years later, the press turned on itself and stopped doing all of that just so it could sell more papers. And that turned out to be a very hard habit to break. And the wonderful piano, the instrument that rode the industrial wave from the beginning, had another 50 years to go, but the signs of the end were already there. One by one, the hundreds of piano makers who'd been improving the product year after year decided they'd done all they could, including about the time that Brahms wrote this last piece in our program, the mighty John Broadwood and Sons of London finally closed their doors. With the advent of recorded sound in the 20th century, the piano was slowly replaced as the musical entertainment in the upper middle class home, just as mechanics are still being replaced by electronics today. In fact, about the only thing from that wonderful boom that really hasn't changed is the idea of the story selling the news, even if that story has to be created. The only difference is today, instead of creating one a day, reporters have to do it about every 10 minutes on the all-news channels. So here's our last piece, from a time when the composer hero was a quiet man who loved the piano, who was a lot more excited about gypsy tunes than he was about Viennese nationalism, and really just wanted to make music with friends and go home to be alone with his thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.